Welcome to episode 371 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we have a grand conversation with one of our regular contributors. He's a student of Aikido, farmer, winemaker, and our resident philosopher, Almighty Todd. We talk with him from his small farm in Stockbridge, Vermont, and we delve into this slow spring. We talk about Yin Yang and Tao Te Ching, John Muir, working in the garden, nature, indigenous cultures on this continent. A wonderful conversation with Almighty Todd this go-around. We have an EW essay titled Free, and a piece by the great John Muir called Calypso Borealis, and a poem called Apostrophe. All of this, of course, is imbued, infused with the wonderful energy of several great tunes. It is so nice to have you with us. Let's get to it. Episode 371 of Troubadours and Raconteurs.
Traffic jam in Manhattan. Below the city in a subway car, she feels just like a shooting star. Never thought she could get so far from her old man. The last phone booth in New York City, ringing all day, calling somebody home. She doesn't. She walks faster. She won't be going back to Alabaster. She won't be going back. She won't be going back to Alabaster. Thousand miles away, she still feels it. Scrape of his chin, bruise on her spirit. Home is calling, but she won't get near it ever again. Steps on the gas just to harness the anger. Last thing he do is try to understand her. Stuck in time like a fly in the amber. Never transcends. The last phone booth in New York City, ringing all day, calling somebody home. She doesn't answer. She walks faster. She won't be going back to Alabaster. She won't be going back. She won't be going back to Alabaster. Distance grows wider, the dark future's brighter and brighter. She's got a new heart beating inside her, and she's her own master.
She won't be going back.
She's her own master.
She won't be going back.
She's her own master. Last phone booth in New York City, ringing all day, calling somebody.
Somebody home. She doesn't answer. She walks faster. She won't be going back to Alabaster. Yeah,
free. I am a hungry ghost. I think you could be one too. We watch programs and read books about the zombie apocalypse to be entertained, though I am starting to wonder if we more truly are watching because we have an innate sense that this is all wrong. The trees have a root system more intricate and far-reaching inside this earth than we see and know. We witness the integrity and beauty as it sways in a breeze, with its leaves or pine needles and cones dancing, at some point disattaching and falling down or floating up to spread and add to the grand dynamic scheme of this planetary hip scene of life and soul, and to some miscreant ways. They travel as seed or add to the fertile detritus of the surface, and two, add smell and color to stimulate our human olfactory and visual senses. John Muir's cathedral, Lao Tzu's Tao, and our day-to-day muddling through, wondering how. You find a time so sublime in a moment endless, with the yellow warmth of hope in the sun's shine. These words of time, me, yours, ours, and mine. And Thich Nhat Hanh's plum village, hear from there these echoing chimes. Through all of this I sit and wait as our leaves of grass sage Walter sublimates to a warm-mouthed whisper and a quiet glimmer of love, true, pure, deep, and as infinite as it is ephemeral. The ghosts are gone, and we are free.
Forgotten hands are the ones which we choose to let go of, but it is
Almighty Todd, is that you?
Conundrum, it is me. Is that you?
Yes, it is me. Of course, it's so nice to have you on again. Troubadours and Rock On Tours, regular contributor, I'm happy to say. He's a student of Akito. He's a farmer, a winemaker, and our resident philosopher. Though as the very humble philosopher that he indeed is, he does not like to be called our resident philosopher. He doesn't think he knows enough, but I sure do. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I just was on my front stoop talking with our friend Kieran and his fiance Patricia Adcroft, who she was on the show a few months back. She's a pretty impressive New York City magazine editor, among other things. She also was part of a family that owns a number of Krispy Kreme donut franchises. And during the pandemic, once a week, she and Kieran come and deliver a couple dozen of donuts to myself, my wife Jenny, and our children.
Oh, that's excellent.
Yeah, so they were making their donut run this morning. Just got, and they wanted to say hello. In particular, Kieran wanted me to share his salutations and his affection from him to you.
Oh, well, then when you get the next Krispy Kreme run, you send him mine as well.
I will.
Him good tidings.
I will.
So that was a meeting in real life. It wasn't talking on the phone or a Zoom chat.
No, we were far away from each other. They had their masks on, we did not. We were just coming off, from the inside of the house on the front stoop. But it was wonderful, beautiful, sunny, mid-spring day. It was nice.
Yeah, it's gorgeous here too today. Completely blue sky. The leaves are just really starting to push and pop everywhere. I mean, I know you're ahead of us by a couple of weeks in terms of the lushness factor, I'm sure.
Yeah, Stockbridge, Vermont, I would say, is probably a little chillier.
Yeah.
Than here in northeastern Pennsylvania.
Yeah, a couple hours drive will do that. But it's coming on fast. It was a slow spring. I mean, it was kind of cool and damp. And, I mean, heck, we had snowflakes in the air even like a week ago.
Yeah.
But the tide has definitely turned now. The green awakening is just it's always amazing. I mean, the pear trees are in blossom. The apples are just starting to blossom as well. So the fruit trees are popping, the dandelions are up, the daffodils are kind of coming to the end. The magnolia tree just dropped its last flower petal yesterday, I'd say.
Beautiful.
I've always really loved this time of year. There's all something to be had in all times of the year, but there's just something about the springtime, this the invigoration of it. I mean, I still have this memory when I was a kid, and this is how I look back and know I had ADHD before they came up with before they invented that term. But it's like this time of year, you're in school, the windows are open, the birds are singing, the wind is blowing through the fresh grasses, and I just did not want to be in class because our homeroom teacher was our English teacher, and she was a witch, and it was just terrible. And since she had the same last name as me, and everybody's like, "Oh, your mother's being terrible to us again today," and it's just like, "Ah!" Oh. And I caught myself. I realized I was gripping the desk so hard, the lid of the desk so hard, my fingernails were digging into the wood because I was ready to scream because I was like, "What are we doing in here? Why aren't we out there?" It was like, I could feel it welling up in me, and I was like, "You have to learn how to control your emotions." as like a fourth grader.
See, you've always been astute. You've always been in tune, and it's interesting. You wanted to talk about John Muir. We will later, but you're sounding a lot like him. I think you guys are the same essence,
channeling him. Well, you know, this is the thing, is I think we're all of that essence. We just are not necessarily in touch with it all the time, or we have it beaten out of us, or we get boxed into lifestyles or social structure. I think we all have that connection to nature inherently, just by being humans. But that social structures or educational paths or ways of being, lifestyle, that take us away from that knowledge or wall us off from it, or in some cases, you know, keep us, you know, away from it right from birth, so that there has to be a rediscovery process to re-engage with the natural world.
You know, and it always, when you talk like that, it just opens up in me something that I've often tried to figure out or try to understand intellectually as well as emotionally, I think. When you look at European Americans coming from, you know, the, quote, civilized cultures of Europe and arriving here on the North American continent or Turtle Island, they brought that mentality to what they deemed savage cultures and tried to get and were successful in large part either getting rid of them or converting them by force to let go of their more natural connection with the environment. And in retrospect, I think we lost a lot. And of course, it was heinous what was done to those folks. But we lost some great human insight and development when we excised their way of life, the indigenous people here on this continent, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, I definitely agree with that. And to the extent that I feel like, and we may have discussed this before at some point, but that one of the greatest opportunities in the forwarding of humanity was essentially missed at that time. When you had the arms of humanity reached around the globe and came to meet, you know, could have been hand to hand instead of fist to fist in this continent. And, you know, the two different branches of thought or development could have, you know, potentially melded into something greater. And I don't think that that's what's happened. There was quite a bit of destruction and undermining of humanity in that process. The funny thing is that, you know, there's even inside the Christian world, there's I don't want to say not at odds, but there's not necessarily agreement in how to see the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's definitely the passages that talk about, you know, after Jesus was baptized, the Spirit drove him into the wilderness to wrestle with Satan.
Yeah.
There's been this notion that the wilderness is this wild, uncivilized, you know, desolation of a place that where, you know, humanity can't reside, or it's something that needs to be subjugated and dominated. But then there are other parts of it, you know, when you look in Jesus' own words, that basically the rocks and the trees and the birds that are all the face of God.
Right.
And so that, you know, that inconsistency is, granted, there are plenty of inconsistencies within religions. So maybe that's just one of them.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was thinking about you this morning. I was doing some reading in various books of Eastern thought. And one was, they were talking about the Qi and the Shen. No, the Qi and the Jing, I think. And one book said the Qi can transform into the Jing, and the other one said the Jing can transform into the Qi. And the way I was reading them, it seemed like a contradiction.
Ah, well, yes, it could be a contradiction, or that's you're basically seeing yin-yang theory in action, that it's not just a duality, but it's a spiraling duality in that, you know, when you look at the yin yang symbol, there's the black paisley on one side and the white one on the other, but then they each have a dot of the opposite color mm-hmm. inside. Mm-hmm. And that's because even inside of yang, there is a heart of yin that rises, and then the yin can become yang. It's a constant flux. It's nothing is ever static in its state. So what you're reading is not contradiction, but more like complementary.
Yeah, I'm limited in my view, given that I'm dualistic in my trained, perception.
Well, here you go. I just flipped open the Tao Te Ching, and I went right to passage 42.
Perfect.
It is the Tao begot one begot two begot three, and three begot the 10,000 things. The 10,000 things carry yin and embrace yang. They achieve harmony by combining these forces. It goes on, but that's the gist of it. The way is universal being that is then seen through the lens of this dualism of the two. The dualism of the two bring a manifestation of reality into being, and then that is the foundation of all the being of all things. That's the 10,000 things.
Right, all things.
That's kind of like the cosmology of the Tao.
So dualism is limiting when you're trying to understand the 10,000 things, or even using words to try to understand the Tao is not possible, right?
Right, it's an abstraction, correct? But the duality gives us a lens through which to look through. I mean, this is the beginning of the necessity of finding oneself as the I and the other. You know, seeing that we exist distinctly, and then there's this stuff that's not us. That's kind of an origin of duality, too. The problem is that we fall into this dualistic world, and then we always see ourselves as separate. And that can be the thing that undermines the constant reminder that nature should be, that, you know, we are just an extension of all of this. You know, that tree over there, that rock over there, the moon rising, we're all made of the same material, the same stardust. It's just it's organized differently in each of our spaces for the time, because even that is temporary.
Beautiful.
Before it sifts back into the essence of everything else around us.
And are we talking about the essence as per the physical world on this orb we call Earth, or beyond, too?
I'd say far beyond. I mean, this is, again, there's a duality in the thinking often of that, you know, physicality is one thing and spirituality is another. And from the martial studies that I do, it's like there is no difference between the two. There is nothing more spiritual than the skin on my body. It's that interface between the inner world and the outer world, because we're mostly empty space, if you think about it. Just like there's space in between this planet and the next one. When they say in Christianity that God made man in his own image, that's where we get this idea that there's this, you know, the flying sky god guy with the white hair and a beard sitting on a cloud looking down on us. And it's just not that. That's just a reverse anthropomorphication of God, making God into our image. The idea is that all of the forces of the universe, all that create everything around us, coalesce to create us too. There is no difference. And whereas some would then, you know, hold us to be higher than the rest of the animal and plant kingdom, and then are somehow here to dominate it, or at least take responsibility for stewardship, that removes the opportunity for the humility that's seen in looking at ourselves as just another atom in space.
Wonderful. Almighty Todd, our resident philosopher, among many, many other things, here on Troubadours and Rock On Tours. Now, you know, how does a Scotsman, as a young boy in Wisconsin, become such a sage, a priest of the natural environment? John Muir, I'm talking about.
That's a good question. Well, I mean, I think that because of the way he grew up, he grew up in a biblical household, so to speak.
Yeah, his father.
His father was a minister, and he had to know the Bible front to back. And so his spiritual upbringing was kind of a harsh one, but at the same time, he couldn't have escaped the idea of divinity, you know, pervasive divinity was just in his cellular structure. And, you know, that was unavoidable because of the way he grew up. He was inculcated with that idea. But, you know, he did study botany and geology in college.
Geology and botany, and he was an engineer as well, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yep. So he had a mind, I think, for systems, and he it was after he had an there was an accident that he was in, as I understand it, when he was working
his eye.
So and he was temporarily blinded, and when he got his sight back, he kind of basically went for a walk as his rehabilitation. And I think what happened was the misfortune of the temporary blinding offered him, when he returned to the sighted world, the opportunity to physically see the world in a different way. But the trauma of that loss and then kind of rebirth into the world, I think made him open to the idea of engaging with the world in a different way. And then the time spent in nature, because of that openness, infused him with the idea that the divinity that had been beaten into him from a book was actually more accessible and understandable in the field, in the forest, in the desert.
Yeah, and he walked all across this continent. He'd go for walks that were like thousands of miles long. He wrote such beautiful prose, I believe.
Yes.
Right?
He did. And that's kind of how he became famous. Was writing out in California, writing for like I think Harper's Bazaar and some other publications that really excited people. Well, this is in the late 1800s.
Late 1800s, and wouldn't he refer to the natural environment as his cathedral?
Yes. Yes, exactly. And that, you know, that he could commune with divinity in a way that he could not inside the walls of a church. And so there was what the heck was the there was a quote by a Scandinavian guy. I can't remember what his name is.
Sven? But it was Sven, maybe?
Yeah, probably a good chance, yes. But it was something along the lines of that it is much better to think about God while skiing than to think about sport while in church.
I like it. All right, Sven.
So,
or maybe it was Ingrid.
I have to go look for that one because
I know at least one listener in Sweden. We have many actually, but I know at least one. Her name is Ingrid. So props to Ingrid.
Maybe she can sort that one out.
Yeah, email us ewconundrum@radiofreebrooklyn.org and let us know who that Scandinavian is, Ingrid, would you? Great statement, though. Great saying.
You're listening to Troubadours and Rock on Tours with E.W. Conundrum Demure on WFTE Radio, Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Community radio at its finest.
So, John Muir and forest bathing as of late has been helping you get through these weird times up there in Stockbridge?
Yeah, well, the crazy part is it's weird, but we're doing pretty well here in Vermont. You know, it's not so doom and gloom. It's just more high alert. But there is a kind of a pervasive anxiety when you look at what's going on around the country and how this is affecting us, how our response to it is affecting us, or lack of response. And so that kind of human error in relationship to this is kind of this reminder to me that of our sometimes our lack of balance and grounding. And when you think about this, they want to, you know, there's this, how can I say, there's a bit of a linguistic effort to turn this virus into the hidden enemy, the invisible enemy, right? Mm-hmm. And that we're at war with this thing, which I find troubling in the sense that this thing is a virus. Viruses have been around for far longer than we have on the planet. If we don't know how to deal with them, that's kind of on us, because they're a naturally occurring phenomenon that in some ways may actually have helped foster the evolutionary process because of the way that they move RNA around. Mm-hmm. now that we know what RNA is. But that the effort to demonize this thing, it's an inanimate object. It isn't even alive per se, the way most creatures are alive. It just does its business in living cells. It's our relationship to the thing that may be the problem. How we relate to this naturally occurring thing. People are wanting to blame the Chinese because that's where it started, but you know, viruses can pop up anywhere. The Spanish flu probably started in Kansas.
I hear a dog in the background.
Oh yeah, that's the guard animal.
It's not your doggy?
It is, and I have no idea what she's barking at.
What's her name?
Lexi.
Lexi.
Hey, Lexi. Lexi, you don't have to bark. Leave it. There's definitely something in the woods across the way. So sorry about that.
No, the virus.
The natural world is impeding on us.
Well, yeah, that's the problem. I think that attitude is we believe the natural world is impeding on us rather than looking at it instead as part of us, right? I mean, even mm-hmm. when you talk about making the virus that we're presently trying to combat, so to speak, an enemy, and hidden enemy, that speaks to how self-absorbed and emotionally immature we as a species, as a society, you know, behaves. We're like children, you know. Why can't I eat all the ice cream I want and not get a bellyache? It's the ice cream's bad. No.
Right.
Your behavior's bad. I don't know if that's a good analogy, but...
No, I hear where you're going with that. And that's where, you know, this idea that I want to go back out. I want to go to the bars again. I want to do this now. I don't want to wait. I don't want to be in my room any longer. I want the bad virus to go away.
There's that. And there's also people in the United States, and I've talked to a number of guests recently about this reality. A number of people in the United States are really scared because of their economic situation, because our system is not designed correctly. But they can't fix that now. They have to think about their immediate needs, like health care for their family, being able to pay their mortgage. And what are they going to blame? These abstract ideas about how our system is, you know, works, socialism and economic philosophy? No, they're going to blame whoever is telling them you can't go back to work because they're afraid. They need to get some money. And I understand that, but really, you know, it's not the bigger problem is our system is messed up. It's not fair. It puts more people in these predicaments. So they have to go back out even against their own best interests because that it's a rigged game benefiting only those in real power, you know. I'm sorry.
No, I hear you exactly. I mean, we've been hearing for years now that half of Americans can't afford a $400 bill for unexpected expenses.
Right.
And so, you know, you've been hearing that, but this situation is laying bare the reality of that. And the challenge is that, yes, people don't want to have to face the complexities that have gotten us here. And they want the simple, you know, the simple scapegoat to at least level their emotional anxiety at. But the truth is that things are complex. Answers aren't necessarily simple. And we can't just because we want a simple answer come up with something and say that's good enough. And this, I think, goes back to the fact that we don't use our capacities to the extent that we can, just in general, that this inability to handle complexity that's a manufactured situation that modern humans have been laden with by making us think that it's simpler than it is. This is where if you spend time in nature and you really deeply understand nature, you begin to see the interconnectivity of all the systems. And I really believe that our brain was evolved to navigate and understand these vast complexities, to make sense of them, to navigate them, to utilize them. And that capacity is something that we could be – I mean it's – in some ways, why we're able to build this complex modern world that we have. But as individuals, we don't always develop the ability to interact with those complexities in a way that we don't find frightening. And so I do wonder what the long-term impacts of our response to this situation are going to be. I mean, there's no SARS anymore because that was a pretty deadly disease and it got contained early and it burned out. We didn't contain this one early. It was as the world, we didn't respond to this quickly enough. And now because of that, it potentially is here permanently. Endemic, meaning it will always be around in some form.
Right.
As long as there are people that have not been infected by it. And even then, we don't know if infection confers immunity if you survive it.
No, that's why it's imperative to get a vaccine. You know?
Right. Now, well, and even, you know, even that answer is, we don't have a vaccine for HIV. Right. After 30 years.
Right.
So this any promises of saying, oh, we're going to have something by Christmas time is, again, I think magical thinking that's being peddled as public relations fodder.
Now, I agree. Almighty Todd, we're just about out of time, believe it or not, with this go around. Our resident philosopher, good friend, longtime regular contributor to Troubadours and Rock on Tours. And we'll continue. I heard Lexi barking. He probably wants you to go outside and throw him a stick or something out in beautiful backdrop of Stockbridge, Vermont. Before you go, though, in a John Muir-esque way. Give us a little something to nourish us until the next time we talk with you.
Oh, I'd say, well, I've often, you know, told people to get outside, spend some time quietly in the forest or next to some water. I think this is a good year that if you don't have a garden of your own, to find friends that would take help with weeding and garden chores. That's something that you can do socially distanced. But I think in this time of abstract anxiety, it's a good time to take your shoes off and put your feet in the soil and feel the earth from which we have risen. Know that we're part of it, and that the time that we spend here is fleeting and limited. And so to really take care with what we do with that time and what we do with our mind energy, where we let it go. Do we want to have it wheeling around about the things that we can't control, or do we want to fill it with the beauty of reality that we oftentimes overlook because we're checking our phone or watching TV or doing something else that's actually distracting us from the very short and beautiful life that we live.
Wonderful. Grazie, fratello.
Grazie. You take care of yourself, brother.
You too, brother. Hope to see you soon.
Yes, I hope so too. And hugs and kisses to the family.
Right back at you. Ciao.
Ciao.
Back to the garden. cost of freedom buried in the ground.
And now we have an excerpt from the Calypso Borealis by John Muir. In 1864, John Muir was wandering through the swamps of Canada, looking for flowers and trees, botanizing, and working at various odd jobs. During this time, Muir long sought a rare orchid, the Calypso Borealis. The story of his discovery of Calypso was his first published writing, having been sent onto a newspaper by his former college professor, J.D. Butler. This is an excerpt. After earning a few dollars working on my brother-in-law's farm near Portage, Wisconsin, I set off on the first of my long, lonely excursions, botanizing in glorious freedom around the Great Lakes and wandering through innumerable tamarack and arbor vitae swamps and forests of maple, basswood, ash, elm, balsam, fir, pine, spruce, hemlock, rejoicing in their bound wealth and strength and beauty, climbing the trees, reveling in their flowers and fruit like bees in beds of golden rods, glorying in the fresh, cool beauty and charm of the bog and meadow, heathworts, grasses, carices, ferns, mosses, liverworts, displayed in boundless profusion. The rarest and most beautiful of the flowering plants I discovered on this first grand excursion was Calypso borealis, the hider of the north. I had been fording streams more and more difficult to cross and wading bogs and swamps that seemed more and more extensive and more difficult to force one's way through. Entering one of these great tamarack and arbor vitae swamps one morning, holding a general, though very crooked, course by compass, struggling through tangled, drooping branches and over and under broad heaps of fallen trees, I began to fear that I would not be able to reach dry ground before dark, and therefore would have to pass the night in the swamp, and began, faint and hungry, to plan a nest of branches on one of the largest trees or windfalls, like a monkey's nest, or eagles, or Indians in the flooded forests of the Orinoco described by Humboldt. But when the sun was getting low and everything seemed most bewildering and discouraging, I found beautiful Calypso on the mossy bank of a stream, growing not in the ground but on a bed of yellow mosses in which its small white bulb had found a soft nest and from which its one leaf and one flower sprung. The flower was white and made the impression of the utmost simple purity like a snow flower. No other bloom was near it, for the bog a short distance below the surface was still frozen and the water was ice cold. It seemed the most spiritual of all the flower people I had ever met. I sat down beside it and fairly cried for joy. It seems wonderful that so frail and lovely a plant has such power over human hearts. This Calypso meeting happened some 45 years ago, and it was more memorable and impressive than any of my meetings with human beings, excepting perhaps Emerson and one or two others. How long I sat beside Calypso, I don't know. Hunger and weariness vanished, and only after the sun was low in the west, I plashed on through the swamp, strong and exhilarated, as if never more to feel any mortal care. At length I saw maple woods on a hill and found a log house. I was gladly received. Thank you.
giggle or grumble for me. Thumb, from where did you come? Did you toddle or run? Did you skip, chip or stumble from me? Sing along, put some pickles on, and play the mellotron. Go down, let's go down, let's go down. Don't you wanna come down and bring along? Count to 21, and go and right a wrong, and feed the pelicans.
Apostrophe. Nellie stands on the front porch, mere meters from the Appalachian Trail. The Delaware indigenous human folk were much more woke 300 years before we Westerners declared ourselves as such. We are a bit much, don't you think? On the brink, indefinitely. So out of touch and out of rhythm with your chi. Solipsistically, she indulges with an apostrophe.
Olha que coisa mais linda, mais cheia de graça. Ela, menina que vem e que passa. Num doce balanço, caminho do mar. Moça do corpo dourado, do sol de Ipanema. O seu balançado é mais que um poema. É a coisa mais linda que eu já vi passar. Ah, por que estou tão sozinho? Ah, porque tudo é tão triste. Ah, a beleza que existe. A beleza que não é só minha, que também passa sozinha. Ah, se ela soubesse que quando ela passa, o mundo sorrindo se enche de graça e fica mais lindo por causa do amor.
Tall and thin and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes. She walks, she's like a samba that swings so cool and sways so gently that when she passes, each one she passes goes ah. Oh, but he watched her so sadly. Oh,
walks to the sea. She looks straight ahead, not at he. Tall and thin and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking. And when she passes, he smiles, but she doesn't see.
Episode 371 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, the almighty Todd, John Muir, and these musical artists, Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, the Wood Brothers, Big Thief, Crosby, Stills, Nash, Cosmo Sheldrake, Stan Getz, and Joe Gilberto, as well as Branford Marsalis and Terrence Blanchard, too. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, let's give it a go and try to enjoy this time. Take care.